This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans. I'm Michelle Bazzi, and welcome to this policy briefing.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Bob Greenstein from the Center on Budget. With me is Len Berman, co-director of the Urban Institute, Brookings Institution Tax Policy Center, and one of the nation's leading tax policy experts. Also here for the question and answer session are a number of the Center on Budget policy experts. We're talking about the recovery package, which the Senate has now passed, and we're going to conference on. I would note that as part of the Center's continued work on this, we have three new analyses today, one on four tax cuts, three in the Senate bill, one in the House bill that are not effective as stimulus, a new paper being posted as we speak, our update on what is happening in state budgets and how extensive the state budget cuts are, and a third paper up earlier today looking at the impact of the reduction in the Senate bill in funding for the state fiscal stabilization fund. Now, the bill that the Senate passed today makes a number of changes in the bill the House passed. Unfortunately, contrary to the claims of their proponents, these changes, those made in Senate committees and on the Senate floor last week, as well as the changes made by the Nelson Collins Amendment, generally have reduced the package's effectiveness as economic stimulus. Despite costing modestly more than the House bill, the Senate bill totals $838 billion to the House's $819, the Senate package would likely preserve or create tens or possibly hundreds of thousands fewer jobs. The reason for that is that the changes the Senate made reduce spending, a fair amount of which, not all of which, but a fair amount of which, was well designed to stimulate the economy, such as funding for state fiscal relief and school construction, and substitute a number of newer expanded tax cuts that are not targeted and are unlikely to provide a substantial boost to the economy, as Len Berman will explain in just a couple of minutes. These changes fly in the face of the consensus of mainstream economists about how to provide the best boost in aggregate demand that the economy needs at this time. Those economists have concluded that, first, well-designed spending measures tend to be significantly more effective as stimulus than tax cuts because much of tax cuts are saved rather than spent. And secondly, that tax cuts are most effective as stimulus when they're targeted on low and moderate income households that are likely to spend a high proportion of the tax benefits rather than on high income taxpayers who will likely save a large proportion of their tax cuts, or businesses that are unlikely to spend their tax cuts to expand capacity or hire workers when the businesses are already producing more than consumers will buy. We're going to go now to Len Berman to discuss some of these tax issues. I will then follow with some comments on what we would regard as some of the highest priority items to try to deal with in conference to improve the stimulative impact of the package. And then we will go to your questions. Now for Len Berman.
Thanks, Bob. I want to focus on four provisions of the Senate bill, and actually I want to touch on one in the House bill. In the Senate, the provisions are the cutback in the refundable child tax credit, the deduction for auto buyers, a tax credit for home buyers, and the provision to extend the so-called AMT patch. And in the House, I want to talk briefly about the provision to repeal a compliance provision, a 3% withholding requirement for government contractors. Before I get to that, I wanted to say something about the debate about tax cuts versus spending, which I think has been really misguided. Almost all of the tax cuts that we're talking about are really spending programs run through the tax system, that is, tax expenditures. For example, suppose the government started offering low-interest loans to car buyers. Everyone would agree that was a spending program. Suppose they designed it so that the lowest income 40% of households didn't get any benefit, and the amount of the subsidy increased with income so that families earning $40,000 would get a $200 subsidy, and those earning $200,000 would get a $1,000 subsidy. It's still a spending program, although now it's a dumb one because it's so poorly targeted. And if you run it through the tax code, it's still the same spending program, and what you have is the auto buyer's deduction. So I sort of highlighted what my complaint with that proposal. So the choice isn't, for the most part, between tax cuts and spending. In many cases, it's between well-targeted spending programs and poorly targeted ones. A lot of the tax cuts are just poorly targeted spending programs. And this is especially important in an economic stimulus package, since most money directed at lower-income families is spent, that is, boosting the economy, whereas money going to high-income families is mostly saved. Okay, so turning to what the Senate did, first they cut back one of the most effective tax provisions in the House bill, the child tax credit, and funneled over $100 billion into provisions that are likely to do little or no good. The Tax Policy Center did a stimulus report card for the House, and we're finishing one for the Senate bill. And the tax provision, we looked at the tax provisions. Most of them did not score very well on our criteria of being timely, targeted, and temporary. The child tax credit, however, actually did pretty well. And the reason is that virtually all of the benefits of the House provision went to low-income families. The child tax credit, just to give some background, it phases in with earnings at a 15% rate. It's designed to encourage work. An important point about the credit is that it doesn't go to anyone who's not in the workforce, who doesn't have any earnings. So even though the House provision lowered the threshold at which the child tax credit started to phase in from $8,500, that was last year's level, to zero, that doesn't mean that if you have zero earnings, you would get a $1,000 child tax credit. You'd get nothing. The amount of the credit phases in with earnings, so that if you have $1,000 of earnings under the House bill, you could get up to $1,500 in tax credits. For example, a family with two kids earning...
I think you meant $150. If you have $1,000 in earnings, you would get $150.
Okay, I think I meant to say $10,000 in earnings. Anyway, it's 15% of whatever the earnings is. Let me give you an example. If you have two kids earning the current minimum wage, which I think is $6.55, they get a $739 credit with the $8,500 threshold because their earnings of a little bit over $14,000, and only $6,000 is above, $7,390 is above that $8,500 threshold. No, I did that wrong. At any rate, they would get the full $2,000 credit with the House bill. And the reason is that with the House bill, the credit, the 15% credit, starts to phase in at zero of earnings, so that family has $13,400 of earnings, and that times 15% is actually a little bit more than $2,000. Under the Senate bill, the threshold would be $8,100. So they raised it from zero to $8,100. And compared with prior law, the $8,500 threshold, they would save $60. Just by comparison between the Senate and the House bill, and this is actually based on an analysis the Center did using our numbers, that 3.5 million additional kids will be covered by the child tax credit. It would increase the credit for 10 million children whose families are currently eligible but who aren't getting the full credit. And it's extremely targeted. 74% of the benefits would go to the bottom 20% of households, and 23% would go to the second quintile. So instead of this highly targeted provision, one that would likely produce a lot of stimulus, if you give $2,000 to someone earning $13,000, they pretty much have to spend it because they're living on the edge. And if they're earning $100,000, they're more likely to bank the money. The Senate actually would spend $116 billion on three provisions that make almost no sense as stimulus. I already talked about the auto buyer's credit. It would allow people to deduct interest and sales tax on a car purchase of up to $49,500. Because the tax code's progressive, the rates go up with income. It provides the biggest break to higher income households. Those are in big higher brackets. They're also likely to buy bigger cars, so they get a bigger tax benefit for that reason as well. And most of the benefit, besides for being poorly targeted, most of it is a windfall. It will go to people who would have bought cars anyway. So in terms of bang for the buck, the stimulus is not a very effective provision. The home buyer's credit expanded on what was a pretty dubious provision in the House bill. The House bill would have allowed basically $7,500 for first-time home buyers who purchased a home through June of this year. The Senate expands the date. It allows people to buy it later in the year, and it doubles the amount of the credit to $15,000. It's a non-refundable credit, which means that if you don't have tax liability, you're not going to get any benefit from it. And again, most of the benefit is going to go to people who would have bought homes anyway, and it's a lot of money. To be able to use $15,000 in tax credits, you have 2 years to do it, you'd have to have something for a couple, something like $90,000 of income each year to be able to use the full credit. It's poorly targeted. Most of it goes to pay for things that people would have done anyway. The last of the dubious provisions is the alternative minimum tax patch. As you probably know, every year for the last 7 or 8 years, Congress has temporarily increased the exemption level for the alternative minimum tax so that not too many people are affected by the tax. I hate the AMT. I think it's an example of pointless complexity, and I think Congress ought to get rid of it and find some other way to make up the revenue. But the AMT patch makes no sense as economic stimulus. For one thing, most of the people who would be protected by raising the exemption level, starting now, don't even know that they'll otherwise be subject to the AMT. It would have virtually no effect on people's behavior this year, and the people who are hit by the AMT, most of them have relatively high incomes. So if Congress didn't pass the patch sometime next winter, a whole bunch of angry people would figure out they owed a few thousand dollars in additional tax, but they're people who almost surely would be paying for this out of savings. So it has absolutely no stimulus effect, and it gets in the way of other things that actually might do some good. Finally, I wanted to comment on a provision in the House bill, which was eliminated in the Senate bill, and that was a provision in the House bill, which was a really bad idea, which was to repeal a 3% withholding tax on government contracts. Congress passed a law a couple of years ago saying that state and local governments would have to start reporting to the federal government on contracts that they let, so long as I think they have to be like 100. The government entity has to have something like $100 billion in such contracts. That's relatively large entities. This is a compliant, and they have to collect a 3% withholding tax. Everything we know about tax compliance is that withholding makes all the difference in the world. The reason that compliance on wages is virtually 100% is because there's withholding. You know that if you don't pay the tax, first of all, your employer already made a down payment on it, through wage withholding, and the IRS will be able to catch you if you don't report it. The Joint Committee on Taxation says eliminating this withholding tax will cost the Treasury $11 billion over the next 10 years. Obviously, providing windfalls to contractors who don't want to comply with the tax law doesn't have much to do with economic stimulus, and it's just terrible government policy. And it has no place in the stimulus bill. So that's one area where the House is better than the Senate. The Senate would have delayed the effective date for a year. That might make sense. The House bill would eliminate it altogether, and it's just a bad idea. With that, I'll turn it back to Bob.
Thank you. And just to underscore Len's last point, just so everyone is clear, that 3% withholding tax is not an additional tax. It's just like your wage withholding. It's withholding some of the tax the companies already owe anyway. And the lost revenue is revenue lost because at the end of the day, without the withholding, some of the companies fail to pay the tax they legally owe. And under this House provision, it is a permanent, not a temporary provision, meaning that it worsens the fiscal picture for as far as the eye can see. Now, what I'd like to briefly do, and then we'll go to your questions, is to just talk about four areas that we think are priority areas on the tax or spending side for inclusion in the final package and where improvement would be needed over the Senate bill. That is not to say that we think the House bill is preferable in every area. It isn't. There are areas of lower priority spending or less stimulative spending in the House bill that certainly can come out. But the four priorities I'm going to discuss are the House provision that provides a new state option to provide health care coverage for the unemployed through Medicaid, the difference between the House and the Senate in fiscal relief for the states, the child tax credit issue that Len mentioned, and the issue of how the fiscal relief that would be provided through the Medicaid program should be targeted among the states, starting with health insurance for unemployed workers. The House bill includes a provision that provides states an option, with the federal government covering the cost, a temporary option to provide health coverage through Medicaid for various mostly low-income unemployed workers who would not otherwise qualify for Medicaid. I should note that while both bills provide a subsidy for unemployed workers to continue their employer's health care coverage through what is known as COBRA, even with those subsidies, the COBRA costs would be so high that low and moderate income unemployed workers generally couldn't afford it. And in addition, many low income workers, those whose former employers didn't offer coverage or were small, don't have COBRA available to them. Now, to see why this House provision is important, consider the following, which is covered in another paper the Center issued yesterday. In the typical or median state, the Medicaid income limit for unemployed parents is 41% of the poverty line. That means that in the majority of states, unemployed parents living at just half the poverty line can't get Medicaid because their incomes are considered to be too high. In addition, unemployed workers without children are shut out of Medicaid entirely under the regular Medicaid rules, no matter how poor they are. They could be at 20% of the poverty line, they would be ineligible. All those people are going to be uninsured in this recession in the absence of this House provision. Now, we do think that the cost of the House provision, $10.8 billion, can and should be reduced somewhat. Without going into the technical detail, there's one component of the House provision that doesn't really effectively have an income limit on it. We think an income limit can and should be put on it. That would reduce the cost of that provision somewhat. Secondly, the part of the bill known as the Education Stabilization Fund. In the House bill and in the Senate bill as it came to the Senate floor, $79 billion would be provided over the next 2 years to states to avert cuts primarily in education, and a piece of this fund was more flexible, and states could use it to avert cuts in areas like law enforcement, services for the elderly, and other basic services of that sort. As a result of the Collins-Nelson Amendment, the Senate bill cuts this $79 billion down to just $39 billion. There would be an additional $87 billion in fiscal relief provided to states through a temporary increase in the federal share of Medicaid costs, but one needs to compare those numbers to the magnitude of the deficits that states are facing, estimated at $350 billion over the next 2.5 years at the state level alone, not counting the billions of dollars in local government deficits that will also have to be closed. The smaller the fiscal relief in the federal bill, the larger the size of the budget cuts and tax increases that states will be imposing, and that will undercut the stimulus the federal recovery legislation is seeking to provide. Now, I mentioned at the top of the call that as we're talking right now, the center is posting its latest update on what's happening to state budgets. And what we find in our new update is that we are now up to 40 states that have cut or have now proposed cuts in services to their residents. That number is growing by the week, and we are now up to at least 14 states that have increased taxes or raised other revenues, with governors in six additional states now proposing new revenue increase measures. And we're just in the early stages of these cuts. Where we stand today, to give you a couple of examples, at least 28 states have proposed or implemented cuts that would affect low-income children or families eligible for health insurance or reduce their access to health services. 23 states cutting programs for the elderly and disabled, at least 26 cutting or proposing cuts in K through 12 and early education, at least 32 implementing or proposing cuts in colleges and universities. The list goes on. Under the House package, the fiscal relief in the package would close about half of projected state deficits over the next 2.5 years. Under the Senate bill, about a third of projected state deficits over the next 2.5 years. The smaller the amount that's closed, the larger the drag on the economy, because the bigger the state budget cuts and tax increases. Third area to look at in conference, I'm not going to spend time on because Len Berman already covered it, and that is the income level at which the child tax credit should begin to kick in. As Len noted, the House bill is at zero. It phases in with the first dollar of starting with the first dollar of earnings. The Senate doesn't start to phase in until $8,100 of earnings. One possible compromise would be to start phasing it in at $3,000 in earnings. $3,000, you may recall, was the level Congress chose last year as the earnings level at which to begin providing rebates under last year's stimulus package. And the final item that I mentioned involved the targeting across the states of the portion of the fiscal relief in the package that would be provided to states by having the federal government temporarily assume a larger share of Medicaid costs. The two bills have the same dollar amount of relief there, but they differ in how it's distributed across the states. The Senate bill does much more of it in an across-the-board fashion without regard to how deep the recession is and how big the budget hole is in the state. The House version targets more of the money based on the increase in a state's unemployment rate, which our analysis shows correlates very closely with the size of the state's budget gap. Now, the House approach is significantly more stimulative than the Senate, even though they both put the same amount of dollars out. The reason is that by targeting the relief more to where the economy is going down more across the states, what the House bill does is it means that virtually all of the money is used to avert damaging budget cuts that would otherwise occur. When you don't target the money on the states that are facing the greatest fiscal distress, you run the potential that not all of the money is used to avert budget cuts or tax increases that would be a problem. So to sum up, the bottom line is that as a result of changes made in the Senate, the Senate's bill is less stimulative than the House bill, even though it costs more, and it would likely preserve or create many fewer jobs. Now, as I noted, that is not to say that everything in the House bill is stimulative and that the House bill is superior in every way. It isn't. But to ensure the highest bang for the buck on this critical piece of legislation, the conferees need to drop or scale back as far as they can the ineffectual tax cut provisions Len mentioned, and on the spending side, they need to go item by item, looking at both bills and looking for the items that have the highest bang for the buck as stimulus. If they make wise choices, they can significantly improve the stimulative effect of the package without increasing its cost at all.
Thank you for listening to this policy briefing from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You can follow us on Twitter at Center on Budget, find us on Facebook, or create a My Center account at centeronbudget.org.